This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Kim Malcolm, sitting in for Bill Radke. Western State Hospital in Lakewood has been in the headlines recently, and not in a good way. Governor Jay Inslee is calling for swift action at Western, which is the state's largest psychiatric facility. That's after two men escaped out a window last week. One of them is a suspected murderer. Police captured both men after a statewide manhunt. The escapes are the latest incidents to raise concerns over the safety of patients and workers at the hospital. State Representative Lori Jenkins wants to see some big changes at Western State, and she wants to start with the staff.
At the very root of it, I think, is the fact that we don't have enough staff at Western State Hospital for either patients or staff to be safe there. Western State Hospital is populated by individuals who have pretty severe mental health issues and who aren't always predictable in their behavior. And so you've got to have a pretty good ratio of staff to patients in an environment like that, and we just don't have it. We don't have it because we're not paying people enough money, and then we get into a circular problem of the lack of safety. Because we don't have enough staff, it's not safe, and then people don't want to come and work there. So there are a lot of things we need to do to intervene, but as I've spent a fair amount of time on this issue over the last couple of years, staff salaries are the things that get people in the doors, and if we can't pay people a competitive salary, we're not going to get people in the doors to work.
So that may be the picture around funding, part of it anyway, but you've also said that there are some longstanding culture problems at Western State. What do you mean by that?
Most of your listeners probably haven't been there, but it's a pretty old facility, very old institution, and even our mental health treatment practices are not 21st century practices. We don't have advanced registered nurse practitioners working out at Western State Hospital. They can prescribe medication pretty much like a psychiatrist can. And so when we think about staffing shortages, we should be using these nurse practitioners much like we use psychiatrists, and that could increase our staffing levels.
You know, some people stepping back and looking at the whole of the problem from a bit of a distance might argue that Western State Hospital is broken. It's a broken institution, and that just adding funding and adding on staff members won't fix the problems that are in front of us. What would you say to listeners who believe that?
I'd tell listeners that I agree on some level. There are many, many endemic problems. But I think part of the challenge is you can't revolutionize those things unless you get an appropriate staffing level. I guess the analogy that I think about in my mind is if you think of Western State Hospital as a boat, everyone who's working there is just trying to bail the water out of the boat. And there are not enough people or resources to build a mast and a sail to actually get it sailing forward. So I think we have to do first things first, and with urgency, though, press forward on improving the care that people are getting.
Some people listening to our conversation, they may not have a personal stake in what's happening there at Western State Hospital in Lakewood, but you've said that everyone should be paying attention to what's happening there. Why?
Every single person in this state knows someone who has a mental illness, who needs treatment, and most of those folks are actually getting appropriate treatment, although we know that half the people in this state who have a mental illness aren't even being diagnosed for treatment. We need to get rid of the stigma around that. We need to recognize that having a mental illness is no different than me, who's had diabetes since I was a kid. I get treatment for it. I'm really healthy, but if I didn't get treatment for it, and if I felt a lot of stigma over having this illness, it would really have a lot of negative impacts on me. We need to make sure that we treat mental illness just like any physical illness out there and get people the treatment that they need and that they deserve.
Democrat Lori Jenkins represents Tacoma in the Washington State House. Last month, state lawmakers agreed to a budget deal that will add 51 nurses to the Western State Hospital staff. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has repeatedly cited Western State Hospital over safety concerns. They've threatened to cut millions in federal funding. The hospital has until May 3rd to meet the federal requirements. We are looking at taxing matters this month. Washington State says low-wage workers, like baristas, pay up to a quarter of their earnings in state taxes. But people at the high end of the wage scale pay much less. In Oregon, the tax system does just the opposite. So KUOW's Carolyn Adolph went to Portland for a cup of coffee to see how the other half lives.
A tale of two baristas. I'm on Northwest 23rd Avenue in Portland.
So what is a puppuccino?
A puppuccino is whipped goat's milk with dog treats on top.
Watching Andrew Layton make drinks for dogs. He's a barista at a shop called Java Hound, which serves coffee to people too.
I live with my partner, my best friend. I make about $1,000 a month.
Working part-time while he goes to college. He's tight for cash.
Like, I don't really go out at all.
And he pays Oregon income tax of around 7%. But it's a non-event.
I get all of my money back. I get everything that I pay into the system back because of being a student.
Because of state low-income tax credits. He does pay property taxes. They're buried in his rent. But overall, his tax burden as a low-wage person is low. In Seattle's University District, Ashley Becker is starting her shift at Cafe Solstice. She's in her first year at the University of Washington.
My intended major at the moment is going to be international business with a minor in Spanish.
And at her hourly wage...
This week I worked a total of 4 nights, probably about 7 hours per shift, so about 28 hours.
She's making around $1,100 a month, about the same as her Portland counterpart. Washington State's Department of Revenue says part-time minimum wage workers like Becker have a huge tax burden. About 24% of their earnings lost to sales taxes, property taxes hidden in the rent, and other taxes. Seems high, and it's hard to parse out. Even Ashley Becker doesn't know how much she pays in state taxes.
To be honest, I don't really try to keep track.
Because it's too hard to figure it out.
We have one of the more opaque tax systems in the nation.
This is Dick Conway, a Seattle economic consultant and card-carrying opponent of our current sales tax-based system.
Even though they have the ability to know how much in sales taxes they pay, few people keep track over time, and over time they have no idea.
So people trying to pay the bills in Washington State will take Ashley Becker's attitude.
There's no sense in worrying about all the stuff that I really can't control.
So the Seattle barista does not know her tax burden, which is estimated to be heavy. And the Portland barista knows much of his tax burden, which is estimated to be light. At least state sales tax rates apply to everyone equally. Equality is good. Go down to Oregon, though, and they talk about another principle.
A sales tax, we call, is regressive. The proportion that it hits your income decreases as your income is higher.
This is Tom Potowski, an economics professor at Portland State University.
So we say that that's not fair.
Why do we care about fairness?
It comes down to a matter of choice. People with good incomes can choose to save money. And when they save, they are sheltering money from the sales tax. But Tom Potowski says people at the other end of the economic scale can't do that.
If I'm a low-income person and I basically am living paycheck to paycheck. I don't save anything. I spend everything.
Oregon has the tax system based on a graduated income tax. It's not equal, but it's easier on people with low incomes.
It's help thy neighbor. It's, you know, it's just all these things that is in our DNA, in our social DNA.
Taxes are part of the reason why it's easier for a young person in Portland to go out on their own than it is in Seattle. But when the two baristas get careers and hit $50,000 a year, their tax burdens reverse. Ashley Becker in Seattle will enjoy one of the lowest tax burdens in the land. And Andrew Layton in Portland will face the higher tax burden. Probably until he moves to Vancouver. As if...
You're the king. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, please call me. I would love to talk more.
I'm Carolyn Adolph in Northwest Portland.
This story was produced in partnership with the Ravitch Fiscal Reporting Program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. This is The Record. I'm Kim Malcolm. Washington state lawmakers managed to end their legislative session without coming up with a way to adequately fund K through 12 education, even though they were under a court order from the state Supreme Court to do just that. If our problems seem bad, don't look at what's happening to our countrymen up north. Alaska has a hole in the state budget, a hole of $3.5 billion, thanks to the drop in oil revenues. That's led to some serious problems with funding education there. New York Times reporter Kirk Johnson has been looking into those school funding problems. He told KUOW's Bill Radke that in rural Alaska, some schools may have to shut down.
I think it's
down.
Very much of a tale of two states of here, Alaska made big, deep pocketed promises to its schools for decades. After the oil started flowing in the 70s and 80s, they said, we are going to commit to schools, especially in expensive, remote, off-the-grid rural communities. And the system and the oil flow, with gaps here and there and crashes, largely allowed them to keep that promise. And now it's really becoming a crisis for them.
You say expensive and remote. I mean, wow, paint that picture of what it's like sustaining a school system statewide in Alaska.
Yeah. There are island communities. There are off-the-road system communities that everything that's there has to be flown in. And they're tiny, too. So you have to build a school, and then you have to heat it, and you have to hire teachers. And there are districts with a handful of students where they spend $50,000 up towards $60,000 per pupil to run these little tiny schools. And that is a real crunch.
What is proposed? How big a hit to Alaska schools?
The University of Alaska would take probably as big a hit as anything. Some of the proposals there would result in 500, 600, 700 job losses and consolidation of campuses. At the local level, the public schools, there was a proposal that was floated and went on the table, and now it seems to have faded out for the moment, that would double the size limit at which a school could exist to be funded at all. Currently, you have to have 10 students.
10 students.
To be a state-funded school. And
maybe on an island, maybe in a hard-to-get-to, hard-to-heat, et cetera,
10.
Spot.
And 10 is a threshold that a lot of school systems flirt with. One lawmaker has proposed bumping that to 20. And below 20, you're not funded. And that would kill off, really, many of these rural communities, since the school is in many cases the anchor of the community. There's a place I've been talking to called Beaver, which is north of Fairbanks. They reached the crisis point even before any of this last fall when they fell down to 9 students. They managed to cob together enough to keep the school going, and they have a kindergartner who's going to rescue the school next year and enroll and bring it back to 10. If the number changes to 20, they're doomed. With that school closing, what parents say is we would probably move with our children to where there's a school. And so much for Beaver, really, so much for these little communities if the school is gone.
So much for Beaver. We read somewhere that oil revenue is so low now that the tax breaks that Alaska gives to oil companies, that accounts for more money than the money Alaska is getting from oil companies.
And it seems to be getting worse. I think it was last week, there was a one-day fluctuation of the price of oil. And the governor said, that's $300 million more from our budget that we got to find.
You hear that, Washington State? You think your lawmakers have money troubles? Here's a similarity between our states, no income tax.
Yeah.
What are the odds Alaska goes to an income tax?
Not good this year. I think that's a tough nut for a lot of the lawmakers to get their heads around.
Because we had this debate here in Washington.
Yeah. And I think the one that the governor has proposed there is a really minuscule. It's more of a camel under the
nose under the tent.
Exactly. Yes. That's what they're saying is, we start
a moose nose.
Where do we go from there? Exactly.
Let's talk about some of that emotion and just the psychology of going from a state that famously pays its citizens with its gushing surpluses to being in this situation, maybe shutting down schools and whole communities. How's Alaska handling this?
There's a lot of denial still. I think there's a certain element of residents and lawmakers who have not really faced up to where things are because they don't want to. When Alaska has had these crashes before, most notably in the 80s, when things were really dire, people left. The people who moved to Alaska in good times said, good times are happening somewhere else. I'm out of here. I don't like the winters anymore.
And what would Alaska be like then?
Alaska has depended on the idea of wanting to go to Alaska. When people start leaving and they don't keep coming, that's when Alaska really starts to stumble. And I think when you talk to business leaders and economic development people, that's the one where they worry is, do our demographic numbers crash? Do these struggling rural communities, if we pull out supports, do they crumble? And where do those people go? If they get into economic trouble, do they drift into cities like Anchorage? And then we have social costs there that we hadn't budgeted for. So it's sort of a demographic, I mean, not quite time bomb, but a demographic, what is the word I would use?
Time bomb?
Yeah, it's a potential time bomb at this point.
Kirk Johnson is the Seattle bureau chief for the New York Times. He told Bill Radke about heavy cuts to education funding in Alaska. It's 12:29. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. Almost done with that book you're reading and already thinking about what to read next? Nancy Pearl can help you with that. She gives us regular book recommendations here on KUOW. Here she is with Marcy Silman.
Nancy, you have brought in a book that upon first glimpse of this cover, I don't know what it is with me in covers. There's a picture of a woman from the sort of Rembrandt era, and she looks remarkably like Scarlett Johansson in the film version with Colin Firth of Girl with the Pearl Earring.
Yeah, which is, I think, no coincidence, because this is a book that's partially set in Holland in the 17th century. The title is The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos, and it's written by a man named Dominic Smith. And we've talked before about how much I really love it when I read a first novel that I love. But it's equally exciting to me to discover an author that I haven't read who it turns out that this is his fourth novel. And as soon as I finished this, I decided that I'm going to go get all the other books and see if I like them nearly as much. So there are several things I liked about this book, but basically it's the story of three different people. A young art historian who was born in Australia and then now is living in New York, making somewhat of a living, doing a little bit of curatorial work, but mainly doing art conservation on paintings. The second most important person, or equally important person, is a very wealthy lawyer named Marty de Groot, whose family came from Holland originally and who owns a painting by a woman named Sarah DeVos. And Ellie, who's the young woman from Australia, gets a commission to paint that painting, to create a forgery of that painting.
Wow.
And the original is stolen from the de Groot household and given to Ellie so she can copy it brushstroke for brushstroke. And she's quite young. She's in her early 20s when she takes on this commission. The third character is Sarah DeVos, the painter herself. So we are transported back to Holland in the 17th century.
So is this a heist novel, a historical novel?
That's the fascinating thing. I like novels that you can't quite pigeonhole. And this is a novel that you absolutely cannot pigeonhole because he's very good, Dominic Smith, very adroit at using the technique of flashbacks. So we spend time in 1957, 1958, which is when the painting is stolen and Ellie does the work of forging a new one. We're then in 2000, when the Sydney Art Museum is going to do an exhibition of Dutch women painters of the 17th century. And then I can't tell you anything else. And then we go back. So it's the 2000s, 1957, and then the 17th century. What I appreciate so much about a book like this is not only that you learn something, but more than that, his writing, even in what I would call his throwaway lines, are so, so wonderful. I would love to see this book get the proper readership that it so wonderfully deserves.
The book is called The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos. Probably the easiest way to find it is by looking for its author, Dominic Smith. Nancy, thank you.
Thank you, Marcy.
The book, again, is The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos by Dominic Smith. And that's Nancy Pearl talking to KUOW's Marcy Silman. You can see all of Nancy's picks at our website, KUOW.org. Search for books. Today is National Equal Pay Day. Why today? Well, it's because if you're a white woman with no kids, you have to work until today, April 12th, to make as much money as a man earned last year. If you have kids, you'll have to work into early summer. And if you're a woman of color, keep working until fall. What would it take to celebrate Equal Pay Day on January 1st? Seattle writer Ruchika Tulshian has a few ideas. Her book is called The Diversity Advantage, Fixing Gender Inequality in the Workplace. She's seen all the advice out there for women to close their pay gap by advocating for themselves. But Tulshian told me, instead, she chooses to focus on what managers and companies can do.
That's really because women face many biases when we're kind of charged with and tasked with solving gender wage inequalities and other inequalities. So, for example, many studies have found that when women speak up or when they negotiate for a raise, for example, since we are talking on Equal Pay Day, they're seen as less likable, they're seen as less competent, they're often viewed as very pushy or non-team players or even worse associations that are associated with working collaboratively. So women are really expected to kind of be more subservient, be very likable, not really ask for more. And a lot of the narrative around solving the gender wage gap is about asking women to negotiate their first salary or negotiate a salary raise. But then at the same time, if they're actually going to be penalized and punished for it, then we're not going to end up actually being able to solve the wage gap in any effective way. So I would say that it's really in the hands of managers and companies to solve the wage gap, not women.
What are some concrete steps they can take to help close the pay gap, these people who are posting the jobs and are sitting on hiring committees?
So the number one thing is to be able to track salary data. And last year, Salesforce did a huge study. The CEO of Salesforce, Mark Benioff, actually had a look at the way men and women were being paid at this very highly tech-forward company. You know, it's one of the most innovative companies in the world. Clearly, you need to have a very specialized set of skills to work there. And even he found, Salesforce found a huge difference in the way men and women were being paid. And they recently announced that they would be spending $3 million to try and solve the gender wage gap within their own company. So being able to track salary data, really having that information at your fingertips about how men and women are being compensated in your company, have that data broken down by gender and by race is very, very important and very valuable. I'm all about training for implicit biases, just making managers and the people who are on hiring committees or who are on the committees that decide on pay aware that, hey, we judge women and men differently. Women are penalized for asking for more. Women of color certainly face very harmful consequences when they speak up, and really making managers aware of that and being able to check for those biases would make a huge difference and being able to close the gender wage gap.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that the gender pay gap has a lot of people rushing to its defense. But here we are. It's April. It's Equal Pay Day. Why are we not solving this problem?
That's a great question. As I said, I think one of the main reasons is that lack of data. So a lot of companies, a lot of leaders I've spoken to within companies kind of come to me and say, oh, that's probably a problem in our competitor's company or in a different industry, you know, an industry that's not as highly evolved as ours. I speak to a lot of tech leaders about this. But it's really about not being able to have that data. So we as human beings fundamentally believe that we're equal and we're fair. And certainly if a man and woman were to come to us with the same, you know, request and in terms of the same data, we'd say to them, absolutely, you deserve the same amount of money for doing the same job. But the way that it actually breaks down ends up being very different. So it's a big part of it is just not knowing and not spending the time and effort to find out.
Seattle writer Ruchika Tulshian blogs for Forbes on leadership and diversity. Her recent book is called The Diversity Advantage, Fixing Gender Inequality in the Workplace. Over the last year, Western Washington has seen some high-profile visitors from China, including President Xi Jinping on his first stateside visit. Well, now officials from China's Forestry Department are expected to visit the Puget Sound region in the next few months. The issue they want to discuss? Whether we could be the new home to a pair of pandas. The Washington State Panda Foundation has been lobbying the Chinese government to bring panda bears here. Ron Lucas is a board member at the foundation. He says having pandas at a zoo here will have a kind of halo effect, meaning people will come for the pandas but stay for the other animals.
There are other great programs which will get some attention and some spotlight with those that come to see pandas. They'll see the rest of the zoo, and that's a good thing.
But not everyone is excited about the prospect of more pandas in the U.S., David Plotz is the host of Slate's Political Gabfest. He's made his hatred for pandas known through his podcast and in articles for Slate. He told Bill Radke he honestly doesn't get why people love pandas so much.
Pandas have been duping us for a generation now. Since I was a kid, it was when the charlatan panda business started. These are animals that don't want to survive. They're evolutionarily a dead end. They don't take care of their children. They don't breed. They eat only one food. They're photogenic. I'm not going to take away the fact that they're photogenic. They're not interesting in what they do and how they live. They are ill-tempered. They cost a ton for American zoos. So American zoos spend these absurd amounts of money to bring in these pandas, all of which is paid off to the government of China. They're a very frustrating and tedious animal, and we shouldn't put our resources into them. We should put it into an animal that wants not to go extinct. Pandas don't even care about saving themselves from extinction.
For listeners who don't know, pandas do seem to have a lot of trouble mating, at least in zoos.
They have a lot of trouble mating in the wild. They're not a lot of them in the wild either. Even when they were allowed to live in the wild and unmolested, they had trouble mating because they're solitary, unpleasant animals that don't really want to take care of their children. We should be leery of anthropomorphizing animals, but let's anthropomorphize pandas for a minute. Pandas are ill-tempered, tedious, neglectful animals, and I don't know why we sit and celebrate them. They don't deserve our praise. The equivalent is having a really good-looking, beautiful child, a supermodel child, and praising your child for being a supermodel. Yeah, pandas are good-looking, but they haven't done anything to merit praise. They're simply good-looking.
I should say, again, not all of our listeners have spent a lot of time actually at a panda enclosure, but didn't you grow up right around the D.C. Zoo?
I did. I grew up right next to the D.C. Zoo, and D.C. was, for a long time, the only zoo in the country that had pandas because the Chinese government, part of the panda ping pong diplomacy of the early 70s, you know, threw a couple of pandas to the D.C. Zoo, and so I spent much of my childhood being dragged to the zoo, and we would have to stand and look at the pandas. And you know what's funny about looking at pandas in the zoo? They don't do anything. They just sit there. And, you know, occasionally they do things that are kind of gross, which I'm not sure are appropriate for a radio audience, and then like there are these desperate efforts to get them to breed. So they'll shut down the panda enclosure for a long time and try to get these animals to breed. They don't really want to breed, but maybe they'll get them to breed, and then the panda will give birth to a little cub, and then it will sit on the cub, or it will give the cub an infection, or it'll just not even notice that the cub is there and not take care of it. 99.9% of the time, it's just sitting there lumpishly spending taxpayer money.
Having grown up in the 70s, though, David, I remember that panda diplomacy is the reason the U.S. and China had not annihilated one another.
Well, I think that's slightly overstated. I would say it's probably ping pong. If I had to pick whether it was ping pong or pandas, I'll definitely pick ping pong.
Mm.
And today, the panda has become this wonderful tool for the Chinese government to extract money from the American public. It's actually like the classic cheap import product. They've found an American audience that is willing to vastly overpay to get access to the shoddy goods, the shoddy merchandise. And so they keep renting us these pandas. We don't even get to buy them. We don't get to own the pandas. The U.S. rents these pandas for millions and millions of dollars. And so then these poor suckers come and see them at the zoo. And the kids come to see them at the zoo and are like, you know, can't we go see an interesting animal? Can't we go look at the giraffes or you know, maybe the lizards or the chimps?
The lizard is a more interesting animal to watch.
Oh, lizard, yeah, like much more interesting. Your average lizard is much more interesting than a panda.
So your message, it sounds like, to the Pacific Northwest is don't do it.
Oh, don't do it.
Don't hop in bed.
Do you know what the Chinese government is proposing to charge Washington State to get these pandas? Millions of dollars, right?
My understanding is that it's $1 million a year with a 10-year contract.
Yeah, I mean, that's silly. The Seahawks should sign another player instead. Anything that the Zoo Foundation, whoever it is, has been duped into considering this should absolutely spend its money on some other thing. It's such a sort of pathetic form of followerdom. It's like, oh, the Atlanta Zoo has a panda. The D.C. Zoo has a panda. We need to have a panda. We can't be a real city unless we have a panda. No, stay out of it. Don't join the panda frenzy, and you'll be so much happier.
David Plotz, he's the host of Slate's Political Gabfest. He made his case against pandas to Bill Radke. A delegation from China will be coming in the next couple of months to determine if the Puget Sound region would be right for a pair of pandas. The Washington State Panda Foundation says if they do make a panda deal with China, they will not use any taxpayer money.